Chapter 10 The Bagthorpes now really began to feel that they were, as Mr. Bagthorpe maintained, ranged up against the whole world. More accurately, they felt that the whole world was ranged up against them. They were used to a moderate degree of unpopularity. People who are brilliant, and what is worse, constantly boast about this, seldom attract warm and friendly feelings from other people. But they did, however surprisingly, have several friends, with the exception of Mr. Bagthorpe, who had none. He was accordingly less affected by this chilling off in relationships. Anyone friendly with the Bagthorpes knew, naturally, that they were not quite as others. Some people found them quite entertaining, and liked hearing about their fires and floods and so forth, but the friendship of these people was now being tested. A lot of the young Bagthorpes' friends were accustomed to coming up to Unicorn House for meals. These were always well worth coming for. People would walk or cycle for miles to catch a slice of Mrs. Fosdyke's apricot cream gâteau or one of her stuffed eggs. Having partaken of these, they would then circulate rhapsodic descriptions of the experience to their acquaintances, and regular visitors were therefore more in the nature of an unofficial gourmet society than bona fide lovers and admirers of the Bagthorpes themselves. It was, then, the falling off of standards of cuisine, rather than the Bagthorpes' plan for survival per se, that was responsible for the rapid decline in their social life. Nobody, as William bitterly pointed out, his latest girlfriend having become cool, is going to walk even 50 yards for lukewarm beetroot salad followed by gooseberry fool made with half milk and half water. The Bagthorpes themselves were beginning to lose their appetites, and most of them were losing weight. "I shall be bankrupt soon," wailed Rosie. Her savings were being rapidly depleted by frequent visits to the village shop for supplementary rations. "It's not fair. Children aren't supposed to have to buy their own food. Their fathers are supposed to feed them. I bet there's a law against it." The idea of taking legal action against Mr. Bagthorpe was actually seriously considered. The younger Bagthorpes were quite prepared to do this, in principle. There was, however, one insurmountable deterrent. The Bagthorpes had had a good deal of adverse publicity during the preceding year, some of it reaching the national press and television networks. A court case brought against a father by his own offspring would only invite further unwelcome headlines. "And just think how that ghastly Book and Esther gloat," said Rosie glumly. "The only reason they're jealous of us is because we've got Fozzie's cooking, and they only have lettuce and nuts. If they knew we get lettuce as well, think how they'd smirk." The truth of this was patent and incontrovertible. The idea of instigating litigation against their father was reluctantly abandoned. The young Bagthorpes, however, were not the stuff of which martyrs are made. They did not suffer setbacks with stoicism. If circumstances did not suit them, they made all-out efforts to change them. If there was no way Mr. Bagthorpe could be coaxed or coerced out of his current obsession, then their only course, they decided, was to enter into it equally wholeheartedly themselves. "There is no question of becoming immortal," Tess wisely pointed out, "if one is not even able to achieve survival." They accordingly dropped their frenzied pursuit of immortality and channeled all their considerable energies into survival. By and large, they were temporarily united in this. Unfortunately, however, there very soon occurred a major rift as a result of certain events later in the day of the Bagthorpes' visit to the hospital. Daisy, upset by her unsympathetic treatment there, set about consoling herself by holding another couple of funerals on her return. Nobody but Rosie and Grandma was interested in assisting her in these, however, because now that Great Aunt Lucy was out of the way, everybody else had lost motivation. Only William, surprisingly, complied. "There's still a couple of lamb chops left," he said. "Might as well tell 'em they're a lion cub and a panda, and let her bury 'em. It'll keep her out of the way." The others did not care one way or the other, and said she could bury them if she liked, but they wanted no part in the funeral arrangements. Nobody even saw the processions, but the ceremonies had evidently been a great success. "I never buried a baby lion before," Daisy told everybody happily at tea time. "And lion rhymes with dyin', so the poem was easy." Daisy made extensive use of poetic license. Jack later saw the tombstone of the purported panda, and it read, "Here there is a poor dead panda, pecked to death by a goosey gander." nobody encouraged this line of conversation, and the matter of the funerals was dropped until the following morning, when it was raised again with a vengeance. Daisy, it appeared, did not just bury her remains and then forget them. She visited their graves to inspect them and sometimes change the flowers. And on this particular occasion she went further. Although she so frequently made use of the phrase, dusters to dusters and ashes to ashes, she had recently been much exercised by the question of whether her corpses actually were metamorphosed in this way, and if so, how long it took. Were the assortment of toffee tins and chocolate boxes used as coffins and recently interred actually now containing dusters and ashes, she wondered? Her curiosity had now reached such a pitch that, being Daisy, she had no alternative but to satisfy it. She had decided to exhume one of yesterday's fatalities first, and then, if the results were disappointing, go back to an earlier corpse, Rosie's hamster, and take a look at that. In the event, her experiment was short-lived. Daisy was an incurably early riser, and the whole household was therefore woken by her shrieks. She ran first, naturally, to Grandma's room, and most other people assembled there to see what happened. No one but Rosie, and possibly Mrs. Bagthorpe, much cared what had happened to Daisy. They simply, being Bagthorpes, found a furor of whatever kind irresistible. It was some time before Grandma, still half awake and befuddled, could elicit from her protégé what was causing her present distress. Daisy was sobbing uncontrollably, and only odd words and phrases were intelligible. "Gone for ever and ever, amen!" she wailed. "And nothing now, not even dusters and ashes and anything! Poor things, poor things!" The baffled Bagthorpes, little by little, pieced together some kind of picture. The gist of what was being said seemed incredibly to be that some of Daisy's most recent victims had been exhumed during the night. "The child is raving," said Mr. Bagthorpe decisively. "That blasted peak is 15 miles away by now, thank God." "Hush!" cried Grandma. "Daisy is distressed beyond all measure." "We're all distressed beyond all measure," he told her unrepentantly. "As, indeed, we can count upon being whenever that unholy infant is in the vicinity. We are to take it, then, that there is a grave robber at large?" "Certainly there is," replied Grandma. "Daisy's word is her bond. I shall put on my wrap and go instantly to investigate." "There's no need for that, mother," interposed Mrs. Bagthorpe. "The dew may have been quite heavy. Jack will go, won't you, dear?" Jack went. He stared in amazement at the soil-speckled toffee tin that had held the remains of the fraudulent lion cub. It was empty. "She could have forgotten to put the chop in," he thought, though without conviction. Daisy was nothing if not thorough. Jack seemed to remember that Daisy was enclosing her chops in plastic bags, and then placing them in their various coffins. He also, now he came to think of it, seemed to remember that this had been at William's suggestion. William, indeed, had been uncharacteristically helpful over the whole business of chop-burying, especially considering his views about Daisy, which were frequently aired, and unflattering to a degree. "It will be more hygienic, Daisy," he had said on this occasion, obligingly proffering a plastic bag. "Oh, thank you, Willem," Daisy had squealed. "What's hygienic?" "It's something everybody needs to be," he told her, "alive or dead." Daisy, while by no means a conformist, nor even particularly hygienic, had been happy to observe this formality. It had been an extra little ritual for her to enjoy, putting the chops carefully into their plastic bags, before enclosing them in their tins and boxes. On impulse, Jack stirred with his foot at the loose soil of the adjacent grave, that of the panda. He could see the pattern of the tin lid showing through. Daisy's graves were all very shallow. He hesitated. It did seem sacrilege of a sort. "It's only a chop," he told himself. He knelt and scrabbled with his fingers and easily lifted out the tin. He opened it. It was empty. He set off back for the house, still carrying it. It would be evidence, he thought, at least that Daisy was telling the truth, if nothing else, though he thought he had now put two and two together. together.